Now more than ever. Lowe's knows you don't just want a low price. You want the lowest price. And with our lowest price guarantee, you can count on us for competitive prices on all your home improvement projects. If you find a qualifying lower price somewhere else on the same item, we'll match it. Lowe's. We help. You save. Price match applies to same item, current price at qualifying retailers. Exclusions and terms apply. Learn how we'll match price at Lowe's.com/lowest price guarantee.
Call up Eddie Vedder, blast that Soundgarden,
yes.
Throw on a flannel. We are going to Seattle in the 90s. We're having a movie night with Point Break.
Oh, my God.
Never been happier.
Point Break, the cultural phenomenon that is Point Break, apparently.
You're not making fun of Point Break,
no,
are you?
No, absolutely. I would never.
Really means
I would
a lot to
never.
Us.
Okay. Girl, major, major, big, exciting news. Tell the fam what's going on.
Everyone, breaking news. Gather around. There's new merch. New merch is happening. It's here, everyone.
It's here. It's queer. It's fabulous. Get used to it. The merch is so... It's also for the non-queers.
It's for everybody.
It's so, so good. And the big news is today, September 3rd, if you're on the Patreon, you get exclusive access for 24 hours starting at 11 a.m. Eastern time, fam. And you get a 10% discount. This discount is good for as long as the merch is up. You'll find the discount code in your email or on Patreon. We'll send it out and post it today at 11 a.m. Eastern time. So the 10% discount is for the Patreon fam from now until we take the merch down.
Yeah, and so Patreon has exclusive access for these 24 hours, but then tomorrow, September 4th, it's open to everyone.
Yeah, and you're going to love it. There's new designs. I think it's the best merch we've ever done.
We're super excited. We've worked really hard on it. The quality is really great. That sweatshirt with the embossed writing on it, it's amazing.
It's gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous. So Patreon fam, check your email or log on to Patreon at 11 a.m. Eastern today for all the details. The next big thing we have to tell you. Today's episode is all about How to Rob a Bank.
On Netflix.
On Netflix, co-directed by Seth Porges, who we're obsessed with, who also co-directed Class Action Park.
Yeah.
We did an interview with him.
Yep.
All about this episode. It is live on Patreon right now.
Yeah, and so much of what we talk about in our coverage of it, we cover with Seth. So
yeah.
He really goes into it. And he's just the coolest guy. He has like such a wealth of knowledge about everything
so
he covers. He's so wonderful to talk to because
yes.
There's like just so much there.
He came in studio. It was so fun. The interview goes really deep. We get a lot of answers to the questions we had in the documentary. So patreon.com for everybody at the $5 and above.
Yep. And happy merch.
Happy merch day. And girl, normally I'd say, what are we talking about? But I already told them.
Yeah, How to Rob a Bank.
All right. So let's just, here's the trailer.
Okay.
This is a robbery.
He was the most prolific bank robber in the Pacific Northwest.
He's robbed 14 banks in Seattle since June of 1992.
This case was spinning a little bit out of control.
He was a smart bank robber. He became our number one priority.
What happened here reads straight from a movie script.
His moniker was Hollywood.
He wears heavy makeup, a wig.
His co-star is this 9mm handgun.
Everyone on the floor!
He said, man, this is the easiest thing. It's like taking candy from kids. And I just thought, this is insane.
Steal from the rich and give to the poor. How noble is that?
People talk about Robin Hood, but in terms of who Hollywood was, we couldn't have been more wrong.
I don't understand how this isn't a regular, real movie. This has Matthew McConaughey all over it. How was this not? This hasn't ever been a movie, has it?
Point Break.
Yeah.
Well, Point Break came first, obviously. This whole thing was really inspired by Point Break, and that's not a joke.
I mean, the treehouse, like, there's so, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
so anyway, yeah, as Julian said, we're going to Seattle in the early 90s, baby.
Be still my heart. It feels like Seattle in the early 90s today, New York City.
Yeah.
It's finally not 1,000 degrees.
For the last 2 days, it's been a little chilly here.
70 and rainy.
Yeah. So we learn about this guy, this bank robber. They dub him Hollywood. We meet Ellen from the FBI. She's this badass lady running the FBI, and she's telling us everything.
She's like,
Hollywood was a unique case for us in Seattle. We knew from evidence that he was familiar with security practices. He knew how long he had before he had to get out of there. He was a smart bank robber.
He was like really smart. But also something real quick about Ellen Glasser. She was one of the first female FBI supervisors.
Yeah.
And she was supervising violent crimes and she was in charge of all the men.
Yeah.
And at one point she says, a lot of the guys call me Agent Mom. And I'm like, Ellen, no. You're not their mother. Don't let them do that. That is misogynistic.
Yes.
Don't let them do it. We don't like that.
I had the exact same thought.
Agent Mom, she's not your fucking mother. She's your boss.
I know.
Respect her.
Yes. Yes. I couldn't
she's
agree more.
Running this shit.
I couldn't agree more. But you know, Ellen says this guy Hollywood became our our number one priority. That's it.
Hollywood. So Ellen assigns Sean Johnson of the FBI. He's like the number one guy on the Hollywood case.
Like, the reason this should be a movie is for so many reasons, because Sean works on the FBI side, and then we've got Mike Megan, who works on the police side, and they were both like really in charge of this case, and they really, really don't like each other.
No, they don't. and they're oil and water. They're the odd couple. One's the brains, one's the brawn. They both want to be the brawn, I think.
But then Sean's like, but I also do think I'm the brain, so maybe I'm the brain and the brawn.
Okay, guys.
I literally have that note. Okay, boys. All right, fellas.
You're filming separately. You haven't thought about each other in 30 years. Can we move on?
It's the peen contest of it all. You know what I mean?
We'll get to peens.
There's full frontal male nudity. Again, Matthew McConaughey. That guy just walked around naked all the time.
Did he?
Yeah, he got arrested once at his house in Austin playing the bongos naked. He'll do that. Good old McConaughey.
Look, 1990 Seattle was a time. It was a vibe. I wasn't there, but I hear it was great. We'll get to the music in a second. But it's like Microsoft. Someone's like, that Bezos guy from Amazon. Thank you. I'm aware.
Melinda's ex-husband?
Yes, Bezos from Amazon. Starbucks. Like, there was just a ton of money that was coming into Seattle. Banks were everywhere, and banks were getting robbed constantly.
It's funny that they're like, there are even banks in the grocery store. I'm like, that's just a suburb thing. Like, there are banks in every grocery store. Yeah. But I mean, like, when I worked at a grocery store growing up, and we had a bank in the grocery store.
There's a bank inside it?
Yes.
How does that work? It's not just like a row of ATMs?
No. I mean, it was like you have the customer service desk, and then there's like a little area that was like also a bank.
It's like when you first land in Vegas and you're like, they have slots.
I know.
At the CVS.
Everywhere.
Anyway, regardless, Deborah, the reporter's here. Deborah tells the children about how important Seattle was to the music scene.
Well, because it was all about grunge, and grunge was anti-corporate, anti-brands, anti-fame.
Nobody cared. Nobody wanted any of that shit. People were literally anti-establishment for all the right reasons. They hated all the oppression. They hated the colonialism. They hated the attack on human rights and the environment and ripping off banks, especially if they're getting away with it. People love that.
And kind of loving the people who are robbing the banks.
Well, the thing is, I also want to say, I won't talk about Pearl Jam the entire time, but like, go listen.
It's also fine if you do.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Hi, Eddie. You've never met.
Eddie Vedder.
Listen to like Even Flow by Pearl Jam. Yeah. Read the lyrics of that. Yes. Read the lyrics of Jeremy. Watch the music video of Jeremy.
That's a dark one.
It's dark, but like Pearl Jam and Soundgarden and like
Alice in Chains. These guys could really fucking sing too.
But they were always talking about social issues. And they mentioned Nirvana. They came out of Aberdeen, but I digress.
Yeah.
I'm so insufferable. I can feel it. I can feel people skipping the 15 seconds. It's totally fine. But they were always talking about these social issues. So the fact that like people in Seattle that were at the ground zero of bands like Pearl Jam and Soundgarden, they were kind of like, you know what? God bless these bank robbers.
Yes.
It wasn't like a town divided, or it wasn't like a town. They were like, we got bigger fish to fry than these bank robbers stealing from the man.
I will say too, A, I was like the D.B. Cooper of it all, but B, I was like, the one thing that's one of the many things this documentary does so well is it really does drive home that bank robberies are not the victimless crime we think they are.
Absolutely.
So
it's not.
It's kind of like, it's cool to love that like these bank robbers are getting money from the man, but there is an actual human toll, and we'll get to that.
Yeah, but and the whole thing is like, they were calling them Hollywood.
Yes.
So like this persona that this bank robber has also created is kind of part of it. It's like, what's the harm?
Yeah, and they keep comparing him to Robin Hood, which is like not really a good comparison, because like Robin Hood would like steal from the rich and give to the poor, and he's like stealing from the bank and keeping most of it for himself.
Right, and traumatizing people along the way.
Yeah, it's not a good comparison.
It's a whole thing.
But like, nobody's sad that Bank of America lost $1 million today.
No. So who is this guy really?
Yes.
His name is Scott. He lived in this amazing treehouse.
And what's so crazy about this is that, like, you see him on the surveillance video for these crimes, and he looks really scary and really badass. But then you see there's a lot of home video footage of him with his friends in this insanely amazing six-story treehouse that he built.
Yeah, he says, I built it myself. No, all of his friends are like, no, dozens of us worked on it. It took 2 weeks.
It was built around 7 trees. And it was really well made. It was like cedar boards and picture windows. It was an extravagant treehouse. There was a huge oven range, and we carried this oven range up the stairs 70 feet to the first floor.
There's a full house up in the trees. And it's not like your treehouse that you built in the backyard as a kid.
Yeah.
It's a fully wired, fully functioning, beautiful treehouse. But I just wanted to say about this Scott guy, the bank robber, Hollywood. In the home videos, he comes off really sweet. He comes off like a really sweet, affectionate, genuine, caring person.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of Peter Pan to him.
Yes.
So, I mean, even his friend Steve is like, well, we'll get more about Steve, but he's like, it was insanely dangerous and we didn't care.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure it wasn't the smartest idea to have an oven range in the treehouse. But, like, he felt, Scott the bank robber, felt that this treehouse was his escape and he can really be himself and he can really be free.
Yeah.
Like, and it was very, like, Jungle Book, Peter Pan.
Yeah.
Sort of childlike wonder of not having responsibilities because I live in a treehouse and like I don't, you know, because we learned that like he was lost in his life and he didn't really have any direction and this treehouse was sort of his North Star.
Right. That's a great way of saying it. And what a North Star. Like it's there. Right. You can see the pictures of it on the internet. Like if you're not going to watch the documentary, which you should, Google this treehouse. It is gorgeous. But we meet his friend Mike Biggins and we sort of get a little bit of the backstory of like this guy's life. So Mike and Scott met at college. They went to this place called Evergreen College.
People that came to Evergreen were in some ways misfits, me included. People are pretty progressive. It wasn't like people taking crazy drugs and drinking and being crazy in that way. It was very earthy, playing drums and taking mushrooms and sitting around fires.
Very progressive and earthy. She goes, you know, like playing drums and taking shrooms and sitting around fires. And I'm like, you know what? I get it. That's just a perfect description.
A guy walking around with a snake around his neck. I hate that.
Didn't love that part.
Why do they do that? Why do people do that?
I don't know. It's when it's on the subway because then I have no way out.
Yeah, then you're trapped on the subway with this. That should be illegal and probably
is. I just can't trust the. I mean, I do think snakes get a little bit of a bad rap. Sorry, Mom.
I know.
That's like the meanest thing I ever said to my mom. She has such a really profound fear of them.
I get it, but it's like, they're just doing what they do. You know what I mean? It's like nobody wants to encounter a shark in the ocean, but it's kind of their house, like you always say.
It's their ocean.
And I'm not coming for your mom. Lord knows I love the woman.
No, I mean, you can't pick your triggers. Yeah. It's just something that she really has, like, vision. It scares her a lot.
Yeah.
Sorry, Mom, but I think snakes get a bad rap. Sorry. I still love you. Two things can be true. So sorry. So Mark is here with us, this friend Mark. He's described as a kind, gentle soul. He played guitar and he wrote poetry.
This is the part where I have to let you and the listeners in on a little thing that happened.
Do you know Mark?
No. I was called, there's another guy named Mike in this documentary that I was calling Mark in my notes for a minute. So I did a search and replace for all Marks. I turned to Mike.
Yeah.
So now this Mark person is Mike in all my notes.
So you did it wrong.
So, I'm just going to have to.
You did the search, the find and replace, but you
backwards.
Did it wrong.
Yes.
Amazing.
So now I'm just going to, we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens.
Okay. I'll take the Mark stuff.
Thank you so much.
So Mark's marriage eventually ended and he moved into the treehouse with Scott. Everyone wants us to know that he smoked Chesterfield Straights about 2 packs a day.
Yeah, and drank a lot of bourbon, this guy.
Great.
But also his daughter lived there. He moved in and brought his daughter with him.
Yeah.
And the daughter was like raised there. And I'm like, Scott, you wore clothes around the daughter.
We're
though,
like
right?
two steps away from a cult.
I totally agree.
This is cult 101.
Yeah.
I'm shocked it's not a cult.
But it's also, they just want us to know that he was like a man's man and they would drink and they would smoke and they would just like be boys living in the woods. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So Suzanne is Scott's sister.
Yes.
And she explains that Scott always wanted to be free. He never wanted to be controlled.
Yeah.
He loved being daring. Like, he built a zip line in the treehouse and he was just like living a dangerous life.
We see this zip line. It's 60 feet off the ground. He like takes it all the way to the end, crashing into a tree. And then he's got to get himself back. He's not hooked into this thing.
No.
He's hand over handing it. And like Mark, the friend, is like, if he falls, he's going to die.
Yeah.
We see the video of this.
And the thing, that was kind of part of it.
Yeah.
Because we get a lot of footage, but Scott really wrote in his journal, and I mean wrote. It's like prose.
It is. It's beautiful.
And he says, a voice speaks loud and clear. Remember what you're here for. I understand, but I do not change course. And it's like, oh, I mean, he was telling us.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so Scott was studying medicine and he was working in a chemistry lab, and that's when everything changed.
Scott was the first person in my life that I'd ever known to produce crystal meth. He would at nighttime go up through the ceilings and crawl into the laboratory.
Instead of being a doctor or anything else, he was going to make the best crystal meth in the world. He's the original Heisenberg.
I have the same note.
Pre-Walter White, pre-Breaking Bad. And everyone's like, no, but Julian, but seriously, if only you could have tried his meth.
It was
the best meth on earth.
It was the champagne of meth.
Do you know who tells us how great the meth is?
Who?
His friend Snoopy.
What?
His friend is named Snoopy. You
is that right?
Snoopy?
Did I miss that?
You were struggling with the Mike Mark thing.
It really was like, wait, which one is Mike?
Says Snoopy, lower third.
Oh my God, that's
friend.
But like really, really loves his meth. Loves it. it, loves it, loves it.
Snoopy is a friend.
The thing, too, is that it's not just that he was studying medicine. He was one course away from graduating with a degree in chemistry and biology.
Yeah.
He was like a pre-med student.
But like, you know what that life is.
Yes.
And he didn't want that life.
No.
That life was a very, you can see every move ahead. He didn't want that. He wanted the treehouse.
A wide gulf, though, between pre-med and making and selling crystal meth.
He's just really good at it. And it's like a fun, easy way to do this.
I hate to be the downer, but like, we have to remember, like, we can't romanticize this. I'm not saying you are, but it's like, this guy's putting crystal meth out into the world.
Well, he learns very quick. So what happens is, we're told it was honestly like the purest, best meth.
He was Heisenberg.
He was Heisenberg. Truly, like, honestly, Heisenberg, no jokes.
Yeah.
So, and we all know how that ended.
Right.
So, Scott was also using crystal meth, and we are told that his use of crystal meth was moderate and controlled, and it was just to inspire him.
Come on, that is not how crystal meth works.
It's
not up to you. You're not using the crystal meth. It is using you. I hate to break it to you.
Nancy Reagan over here. I don't know anything about crystal meth, really, other than Breaking
Bad.
I
mean, me either, but it's just like, that, like, I, you, like, there I is no such thing as a casual crystal meth user.
That's what I've been told.
Yeah.
You know, I know people who have used things harder than crystal meth, and I think they'd put it sort of in the...
Jesus, there's things that are harder than crystal meth.
I like heroin, you know.
Is
like,
that worse?
I would think that it's maybe, again, on maybe just on the same level.
Listen,
I don't know
to
anything
us.
From
what
anything.
What are we talking about?
But,
the hardest drug I ever did, I'm doing tonight when I get home. It's called bourbon.
It's called bourbon. So here's what happened, though. So Scott is a full-blown cook, meth cook, right?
Yes.
And he like made this lab on his big piece of property, like under the treehouse. And now Scott would make the product, and Captain Pat was the man with the money.
Captain Pat was the front man. He was the finance man. The only times they met were in the forest, transferring product and money. When Scott would bring 180 pounds to Captain Pat, he would give him $2 million.
Captain Pat would give Scott $2 million, and they'd go their separate ways.
Let me ask you a question. Did this transaction happen more than once, do you think?
Yeah.
What are we doing here?
You know what I mean? No.
Who needs more than $4 million?
Yeah.
Let's say like this transfer happened four times. This guy's got $8 million.
I know.
Because what happens is like Captain Pat gets murdered, and then all of a sudden like Scott is devastated, but now he like needs a different form of income.
I know. Isn't he a millionaire many times over?
Living in a paid for treehouse in the woods? Like what? And like everyone's going to say to us, he's just an adrenaline junkie. Like it really isn't about the money. He needs to be robbing banks or making crystal meth. But I'm like, I think you have enough money.
Yes, it's
you
not
know
about
what I mean?
The money.
Yeah.
1991 comes along, and Scott discovers the iconic film Point Break. You think I'm kidding?
No, do you love this movie?
Yes.
Keanu Reeves
is Johnny Utah. Are you kidding me? Patrick Swayze is Bodie.
And like
Lori Petty is Tyler.
I know. Lori Petty is the best. But like both of like Patrick Swayze and Keanu Reeves at the top of their just like beauty. I know.
So this is about bank robbing surfers.
Yeah.
If you don't know Point Break, please get yourself educated. That's your homework for today.
Yeah.
The bank robbing surfers are called the ex-presidents. So they wear like Halloween mask, but it's like Reagan and Kennedy
Nixon,
or whatever.
Yeah.
Scott the bank robber is inspired. So he needs money, quote unquote. And instead of cooking meth, he's going to be a bank robber. And his friend Mark is going to be in on it too.
And it's just like, oh, guess what? Scott's instantly great at this. So it's June 25th, 1992 at Seafirst Madison Park. That's the name of the bank. And it's like Mike and Scott are just doing it. This their first robbery.
He's wearing the Reagan mask a la Point Break.
I know. But they're doing it just to kind of see how it goes. I love that they're like, we're going to be great at this. Let's do one trial run. Like, if it were me, I would just be like, I would walk into the bank and then walk to the security guard and be like, just take me to jail.
Uh-huh.
Just put me in prison right now.
Yeah. 100%.
You know what I mean?
But they're not great at it at first.
Yes.
So they rob the bank. They're using each other's real names.
They use
a customer's car. Is the getaway car, which is so traceable.
And they've got to, like, they have to ask the guy for the key, and they're like, the guy was literally shaking in his boots.
Right, and then, like, the meetup spot for the van isn't there.
My friend panicked and went to point B. We had a backup. And we end up running across this golf course. We could hear police cars coming, their sirens.
They finally get to the van, and if you want to use the word success, I guess it was a success because they made it out unscathed.
Yeah.
But they, I mean, a lot could have gone wrong.
Yes.
Is the point.
But they get home and they realize that they didn't make a lot of money.
But like, Scott's like, I want to do it again now.
But Mark is like, I got to get out of here. Like, this is not worth it. What are you doing? He like runs off to Montana. But like, yeah, you're right. Scott, we have to keep reminding ourselves, is a very, very smart person.
Yeah.
And so I think that he saw how it went the first time, and he's like, all we can do from here is improve. Like, and we got to.
Yeah. So they get like $20,000 for the first robbery. So yeah, BFF Mark runs off to Montana. He's out.
Yeah.
Scott wants to learn from his mistakes. He's like, I could really be good at this.
Yeah.
Let me watch Point Break again.
Right. And he's also A, of course.
Like, but I'm not kidding.
No, I know. Totally. But B, he's like, I think I can do the inside stuff myself. I just need somebody to manage the outside stuff.
Enter Steve Myers.
Like, this guy is such a blowhard.
Scott's accomplice.
Oh my God. All he wants to do is talk about like what an amazing artist he is and how like being an artist really that like if he's in a job interview for bank robbing, he's like, these skills really translate.
Yeah. Also, they're playing that song Goodbye Horses.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, but Silence of the Lambs ruined that song for me. And I know I'm not alone.
No.
That's when Buffalo Bill's like, I'd fuck me.
Oh God.
And it's Goodbye Horses. Like,
oh my God. Buffalo Bill is the creepiest character in Silence of the Lambs.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's really bad.
Are you saying that like a hot take? It's Buffalo Bill.
I know, but it's like you would think that like Hannibal Lecter would be the creepiest. I think Buffalo Bill's creepier.
Yeah.
I think we should, this is officially a film podcast. We used to be a fishing podcast. We started out as a true crime podcast, went right to fishing. Now we're a movie recap podcast.
I mean, we're a Point Break appreciation podcast. First and foremost.
But like Steve is in right away.
Doing what Scott and I did is the most creative thing I've ever done in my life. Much more than the art world. Finding the perfect bank was a moment of exhilaration. It's like finding a piece of marble that is perfect for some image that I have that I want to sculpt.
He says it like finding the perfect bank was a moment of total exhilaration.
Yeah, but here's the thing. It's August 14th, 1992. They go back to the first bank.
You know what? It's interesting because they make this point that they kind of do this a lot. And they say that we do that because no one ever expects the same bank to get hit twice.
Yeah, well, idiot cops, could you sit on the bank for a couple weeks and see if it happens? Because he's going to do it again.
I know.
At this point when it's like, oh, he went there for the seventh time. Can you just have someone?
Yeah, it's true.
So according to Steve, this their second robbery, flawless. They went back to the same bank. Steve waited in the car.
Yeah, yeah.
Scott, cool as a cucumber, walks in. Oh, and because Steve's like, no more Point Break masks. Because Steve doesn't like Point Break, like an idiot.
Like an idiot. But this is kind of important. Like, this is the look of Hollywood where he's like, we're not going to give him a mask. We're just going to do some prosthetics and like make him look like a disfigured person is kind of like what they do.
Whatever.
And so, because he's saying like this kind of works to their advantage because when he walks in, people just think he has a skin condition and nobody wants to look at him.
Right.
So like it gives him a little bit of extra time when he like walks into the bank.
Yeah. So they drove back to the treehouse and they come, robbery number two, about $8,000.
Yeah.
Right. So we meet Mike, a detective for Seattle PD, and he says something and I'm like, Mike, I have a question. So he's like, I am clearing cases left and right.
In the early 1990s, I arrested my first bank robber and I thought, shit, this is like shooting fish in a pond. I don't mean to say it in a braggadocious manner, but within a period of 5 or 6 months, I cleared close to 80 cases, and it became very addictive.
I hope you were as accurate as you were prolific.
Uh-huh.
We wouldn't want some innocent people in prison, would we, Mike?
No, but also 80 bank robberies in Seattle? What is going on?
I don't know. Just cases.
Just cases in general?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, then I'm with you.
Right.
Yeah.
Mike.
I know.
Are you just clearing them to get them off your desk?
No,
he tells
us why. He's clearing them because it was addictive.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can we get
some eyes on Mike's cases?
I mean, how many innocent people do you put away when you're working
I thought we were just talking about bank robberies.
I heard cases.
No, you're probably right. I just assumed it was cases of bank robbery.
Yeah. So they're robbing banks. Robbery three is like $9,000. Robbery number four, $5,000. Now, Steve, the accomplice, is like, this is bullshit. This risk is huge. And like, this is our reward. We need to do a bigger payoff. We have to go to the vault or I'm walking. That's it.
Yeah, because it really isn't worth it. Like, because remember, Scott is doing it for the thrill of the bank robbery. And Steve is doing it.
He's Heisenberg. He's got millions of dollars.
He's sitting on his meth money. What is he doing? But Steve is like, yeah, we got to do the vault or we're out. So they hire this girl named Mustang.
Who Steve was absolutely in love with. She's the one who got away.
Yeah.
He was infatuated with her. We don't meet Mustang. We don't see Mustang.
Yeah.
But he's like, she is the most angelic. I mean, he loved her.
He loved her.
Mustang was a special young woman. I've never quite met a woman like her. She was hired to work in the C-First Bank as a teller. She got the manuals and she got all of the bank protocol for teller stations, for the vaults, the armored car deliveries.
They have Mustang get a job at the bank to learn how to get them into the vault.
She's
very smart.
She's a special young woman. I've never met anyone like her.
How is this not a real movie? All of these characters, I could cast this thing right
her
now.
Her name's Mustang. She was probably smoking. She was probably so cool.
Yeah.
She was
Jennifer Lawrence, no
question.
She was
like a Penny Lane type, but only 90s Seattle. Oh my God.
I know.
Probably like wrote a zine.
She wrote a zine.
So fucking cool,
you know,
man.
What though? She definitely fell for the J.T. Leroy scam,
for
I think.
Sure.
You know what I mean? She
for
loved
sure.
that book, Sarah.
Oh man. So anyway, Mustang, she worked as a teller in this bank. So she's getting the manual, she's getting the protocol, she knows all the terminology. Basically, anything you need on the inside to do a flawless bank robbery, Mustang has your back.
Which, like, I gotta tell you, it's not an idea I would have thought of. I would have been like, how do we get into the vault? We'll never figure that out. I guess what's the next idea?
You should not be a bank robber.
No. I mean, for
like,
so
for a million
I mean, maybe for the sheer entertainment value, I should do that for my
country.
For whose
entertainment value? For not like, yours. You're going to be crying the whole time.
I know. I'm saying that's the entertainment value. Yeah. I'm saying for you all.
Yeah, you're scared that you're going to be forced to do cocaine in the bank.
Totally.
You're scared that someone's going to, like, shove weed in your mouth.
No, I'm right where I should be. I say it every time.
So November 19th, 1992, C-First, Hawthorne Hills. They're switching up banks now.
Yeah.
They have all this info from Mustang. They're going straight to the vault.
We learned there's a vault teller.
Yes.
So he walks in and he's like, who's the vault teller?
This was the phenomenon of Scott. He could control the lobby and still deal with the vault at the same time. He wants them to be calm, go over there, just open the vault. There's no problem. Don't worry. Everything will be fine. Just let me get in and get out.
Remember, Scott's alone in the bank. So they walk in. He demands the vault teller. She takes him to the vault. And, like, now he's got to manage the front of the bank, which he can't really see, and there isn't anybody sort of holding them hostage, and get into the bank to, like, clean out the bank full of cash.
And he does it.
Yeah.
And because he's like, hey, don't worry, vault teller. Everything's going to be fine. I'm going to be out of your hair in, like, 2 seconds. Have you seen Point Break, by the way? It's amazing.
It's my favorite movie, by the way.
Scott.
But I was also saying, like, at one point, the vault teller is standing behind him, and I'm like, why didn't she just lock him in there?
We're not going to do that.
Okay.
What would you do? Nothing? Scream and cry in the corner?
Well, but that's what I keep saying. This is what makes this job, like, of being a bank robber so great. Because who cares? Nobody in the bank is going to try to stop you. They don't have any emotional investment in the bank. Just take whatever you want.
And, like, I just want the trauma to end.
Yeah.
I just want to not be terrified. Can you just leave anything to make it stop?
Exactly.
So this robbery is the big game changer that Steve the accomplice was looking for, because it's like $250,000.
Yeah, their total take now is $322,870.
Which is $723,000 today.
Wow.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
And that big, that $252,000 is really what Steve wanted. He was like, now we're talking. Now I can put up with the risk.
And Steve says this big haul was a game changer. It was a game changer not just for us, but for the FBI. Because the FBI had told us, like, they weren't really on our radar at this point because, like, look, $19,000 is a lot, but we got bigger fish to fry.
Yeah, but now the vaults.
Yeah.
Are making the FBI pay attention, but also, like, it is a major risk. It's a bigger risk than before because a lot could go wrong. You don't have as much control when it's a vault. There's a lot of time that's ticking.
And you can't see why aren't people in the front just running out the door?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
So we learn a little bit about Scott's childhood from his sister, Suzanne.
Yeah.
And we learn his parents loved the treehouse. Like, his family loved that he finally was able to make this treehouse.
His dad, like, loved building things. And so, like, the dad was really obsessed with the treehouse. The dad really loved his kids. The dad was Suzanne says they grew up in a loving home. The dad was a beloved minister. The mom was a teacher for learning disabled children.
And so Scott and Suzanne, they're like, that's great. We super loved our childhood.
Yeah.
But the fact that their parents were so, you know, like, held up on such a pedestal in this community, they didn't want to be, like, the goody-two-shoes preacher and teacher's kids.
No, and Scott especially, like, from a young age, he's learning how to pick locks. And in his teenage years, they say he becomes, like, really secretive and got good at telling just the parts of the stories that would, like, keep him out of trouble.
Yeah.
And there's this one story.
There were showroom houses all around Reston, Virginia. We knew how to get into all of them. Scotty and I both learned how to pick locks. We did not learn to pick locks to steal anything. We learned how to pick locks so we could get to the other side of the door.
He'd pick a lock and then not steal anything.
Yeah. But they say, like, I thought this was kind of important that, like, Susanna's saying that the parents are recognizing that, like, in his youth, Scott was realizing that he was really good at, like, living outside of the boundaries of the law.
Mm-hmm.
And that, like, it seemed like that was his destiny.
Yeah, because he didn't want to be in a box.
Yeah.
He wanted to be in a treehouse. And I'm not saying that as like a show. It's just like he wanted to be Peter Pan in the treehouse.
Yep.
And his friends would come and go.
Yeah. And there's like a lot of enabling, I think, among his friends. Like, I think it's okay to tell the people that you love, like, hey, like, you live in society. And so, unfortunately, you have to, like, live by society's rules.
Not when you're a millionaire and you can live in the forest in your treehouse.
Yeah, but I do think it's our responsibility to tell our friends, like, come back. You know what I mean?
If they're doing something wrong.
Yeah.
If you just want to live.
Banks.
Right. If you want to, like, live off the grid and live in your beautiful treehouse in the Pacific Northwest.
I'm just talking about Scott specifically. I'm just saying that, like, he's, when you're starting to recognize that, like, kids are going off the rails, it's okay to try to pull them back a little bit.
Sure.
You know?
So Scott and Steve have, like, a full-blown bank robbing operation.
Yeah.
Point Break come to life.
They're really good at it.
And they're hiring their friends to do this shit, right?
Yes.
But they'd also, like, put hair in the back of the car to plant evidence and make things confusing.
Well, because they're trying to throw the cops off by letting the cops think that they found the getaway cars, which they had actually planted and filled them with clues that would throw them off. It's very smart.
And they'd have Snoopy being the lookout guy.
Yeah.
Snoopy.
Also, Scott comes up with this ingenious plan to launder the money through casinos. So he would do this thing where they would find a game, like a football game.
You place the same amount of money on both teams that are playing at two different casinos, and one of the teams is going to win. So you end up getting back all your money except for what the house receives on the losing team, which is 5%. We weren't losing anything, really.
So one team wins, basically doubling their money. So they lose the other money, but they aren't losing any money at all.
So you get your money back.
Yeah.
Except for the 5% fee that the casino gets when you lose, which is like the cost of doing business. It's the cost of laundering your money.
I mean, it's genius. Like, is that how everybody does it?
No.
Okay.
Lots of laundromats.
Yeah.
Maybe Mattress Firm, depending on what side of the internet you're on.
But that's like such an ingenious idea. Like, we could cut 4 seasons off Ozark.
It definitely happens a lot in casinos.
Yeah.
Laundering money, it's all cash.
Uh-huh. Exactly.
Restaurants.
Yeah.
Laundromats.
But I guess if you're like, I mean, you know, if the IRS is looking at this eventually, they're like, you bet correctly on every game for the last 10 years.
And then it'd be like, no, I was doing it for fun. I bet on everything.
Uh-huh.
I bet on both
of
them.
Yeah,
what do you want
true.
From me?
Yeah. Because you got the receipt from
so
the one that you lost.
To fry?
Totally.
I lost 5% to the casino anyway. What do you care?
Right.
But the thing is, his friends aren't asking him what he does for money. They're like, is he on the CIA? Like, what is he doing?
He's a pot grower, one of them says.
I'm like, okay.
I know.
No one really cared. It was fun in the treehouse. And he was like, because everyone knew him as like this really nice, sweet guy who was just like a little lost and wrote in his journal and was like fun Peter Pan. And
he would also like give money to his friends. Like, we get a lot of like, he would help people and he would give them money if they needed it. And, you know, it was kind of like, I guess when you're in that inner circle, you aren't asking questions.
And
we
he also like was donating to some environmental causes.
Yes.
He wanted to help save the forest. And
yeah.
You know, he saw himself as the Robin Hood figure, but his friends today are like, yeah, not really.
Yeah.
Because you stole from a bank, which did have real people's money in it. And then you'd like, you'd give it to your friends so they'd help you.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, woof.
I know.
Elizabeth is speaking the truth here. Because she's like, yeah, you would only give money away. So you'd be like, hey, Snoopy, can you be the lookout?
I mean, exactly.
And Snoopy would be like, absolutely.
Exactly. And you know, and then at some point they say like things had to stop going perfectly at some point.
Right.
So like at one point they had to abort one of their missions because a customer recognized him as he was going in because he's got that prosthetic
face. Yeah, hey, Hollywood.
Hey, Hollywood. And then one of them, like a dye pack, blew up in the getaway car. They had to abandon the getaway car and the money. And Sean from the FBI, who like really wants to get this guy, he says,
we found the vehicle just blocks away from the bank. I sat in that station wagon at the scene for a couple minutes, just absorbing that. That was the closest I had come to him at that point in time, sitting in that car waiting for the next robbery to happen.
This is as close as I ever got.
Just rent Point Break.
Exactly.
Honestly, it's all there. Even the ending is there. Really, like, we'll get into it.
But they are able to make composite sketches of the people who bought this getaway car from going to the people that they bought it from. So this is a one small break in the case.
Yeah, but the cops are really, they really need help. So they go to the media.
Yes.
And quote Hollywood. And naming him Hollywood, of course, people are going to pay attention. But police turn to the media.
Yes.
So now Hollywood is number one on the FBI's most wanted list. Like, of course he is.
Yeah.
Hollywood based on Point Break. And you know what I mean? Like, of course everyone's going to pay attention.
Well, and of course, like, the media loved it, but the only person who loved it more was
Scott. He's hit more than a dozen banks in the last 4 years.
Yeah.
They're calling him Hollywood.
I
He's
know.
On TV.
He gets to live in a treehouse in the woods.
This is great.
All and the meth you can do.
And the cops are so clearly struggling. This is perfect.
Yeah.
They're sticking it to the man.
Yeah, and it's like, quit while you're ahead, girl.
I
you know what I mean? Why does nobody ever quit while they're ahead?
No, instead, it's 1995. We're going back to the very first bank.
Yeah.
January 1995. And that's when I'm like, no one was camped out at the bank. You have him on FBI's most wanted list. You guys are very obviously publicly scrambling.
Yeah.
You know he returns to the scene of the crime, literally. Can you get eyes on the bank?
There's this one bank that they hit that they knew they wouldn't be able to beat the cops out. And so they build this ingenious plan where he goes in, robs the bank. Steve's like, I'll sit at the restaurant across the street, let you know when the cops are gone. You take out the bottom of your van and just go, like, lie in the floorboards.
Yeah.
So he goes in, robs the bank, goes back out to the parking lot, gets in his own van and, like, lays down. And the cops are there for 45 minutes. They don't find him. And they get away with it.
And they go away. And they got $252,000.
Yeah.
So this is robbery number 14. And the total was $939,000. Today, that's $1.9 million.
I'm like, well, it's much easier making the meth, though, I would imagine.
I mean,
every time he gives 180 pounds, he gets $2 million.
And then you get to be totally separated from the horror that meth does to the community.
Exactly.
You just get to live in the treehouse.
What I thought was really interesting here, and that came as kind of a shock to me, now we're starting to hear that, like, Scott, when he was doing the robberies, was kind of a piece of shit.
He was nice and calm until he wasn't.
Yes. Because, like, we see him in the home videos and we hear his friends talk about how much they love him. You think he's like a sweet
naked
guy.
Naked in the treehouse.
Yeah, and you think he's like, oh, he's the sweet bank robber. No. He could be a real son of a bitch.
And tellers were, like, coming out with stories.
He got more desperate sometimes. He tried to get in the vault. The vault tellers weren't there to let him in. He got real upset. He said, it's Christmas time. I don't want to kill anybody. And he used a stun gun on one of the employees. So he was willing to use weapons.
And he's, like, waving guns in people's faces.
Now, we meet Susan Todd. Susan, I have so many questions.
Okay.
Because Susan has been robbed. She's a bank
14
teller.
14 times.
She's been robbed 14 times. One of them was Hollywood.
Yeah.
My question is, Susan, and I'm asking you this, really, is it worth it?
I know.
Like, you must love this job so much. Because I would think after the seventh time being traumatized by being robbed at gunpoint as a bank teller, you're like, there's got to be a better gig.
And I wonder, too, if it's not just built into the price of doing business.
I guess, but how much trauma,
I know.
How much can someone really take? Because Susan's like, I have to tell you, it never leaves you.
Yeah.
And she's had that experience 14 times. And while Susan is talking 14 times, and I'm not, like, making light of it, I'm really asking, like, at what point does a human person say, I can't live like this?
No, I agree.
Like, she's waking up in the middle of the night, she's looking over her shoulder all the time, and as she's saying, like, it never ever leaves you, Hollywood's friends are like, especially for the bank robber.
I know.
You know who it's the hardest on, Susan? Our friend Hollywood.
It's true, because they're like, he's isolating, he's stressed, he's closed off, he's less social. The vibe of the treehouse is totally different now, you guys.
Okay, now I'm sorry, I know we're doing the Point Break, and I know we're doing the 90s Seattle. I have to talk about The Sopranos, I'm so sorry.
Okay.
Because in season one, Tony survives an assassination attempt, right? It's season one, it's very early. The feds want him to flip, which is never going to happen.
Okay.
Never. Now, Carmella, of course, is like, Tone, this is our out. Like, flip. Now, he's in the hospital bed, and he's just perfect. And this is why The Sopranos could be so fucking funny. And she's looking at him, and she's like, Tone, you got it. He goes, I took an oath, Carmella. She goes, what are you, a kid in a treehouse? And he's like, what do you want to do? Move to Utah, become Mr. and Mrs. Mike Smith, we'll open a rattlesnake ranch? Like,
oh,
what the
God.
Fuck do you want from me?
But
she goes, what are you, a kid in a treehouse? I took an oath, Carmella.
A rattlesnake Edie Falco, ranch. You just can't beat it.
You can't beat her.
I've watched Nurse
Phenomenal.
Jackie all the way through at least three times.
You want to hear something sad that she said about The Sopranos?
Yeah.
She doesn't watch it because it's like watching her home movies.
Oh.
Because she misses James Gandolfini so much.
Oh, that is sad.
Isn't it sad? I'll watch it, Carm. I mean, Edie.
So, you know, Steve is saying...
Scott started to get stressed. He was no longer the casual, happy-go-lucky person. That person was gone.
The vibe around the treehouse changed. He became more closed off, more isolated, way less social.
Everyone's like, I don't know what happened, but Hollywood really started changing. Well, he's on America's Most Wanted. He's number one on the FBI list.
Yeah.
A life like this breeds deceit and strife and chaos.
And
like, give me... Oh, he's really changed after bank robbery number 15.
He also, like, can't be honest with anybody. He can't tell anybody what he does. He can't really probably even enjoy the money that he has because he can't, like, spend it because then people are like, how do you have the money?
Right. So Scott is hating this. He realizes, like, I don't know. He flew too close to the sun and he's super anxious. He's self-medicating with a lot of booze. And Scott's like, I want to do one last hit. I want it to be like the biggest bank robbery that we do. I want it to be like three or four banks all in a row in the same night. I want it. It's like $10 million.
This
and
doesn't
then I'll
make
be done.
Any sense to me. Now, like, we've seen them hit some really big banks. The most they've ever come out with was like $250,000 in one hit.
Yeah.
I'm like, where are these banks that are just storing $6, $7 million?
They're not.
Yeah.
And even before this, like, they're not.
Right.
Because they say we wanted to decimate the city of Seattle. And I'm like, I don't don't think Eddie Vedder would approve. Are you kidding me?
I mean, why do you want to, like, why are we saying it like that?
And also,
the city of Seattle has been very good to you, Steve.
Like, please, you know? They were rooting for you the first couple robberies. Stick it to the man.
100%.
And also, again, I'm not making light of it. This is also right out of Point Break. Because in Point Break, Patrick Swayze wants to, like, surf. It's called the Bell's Beach in Australia.
Uh-huh.
So it's like the 50-year storm. He knows it's going to be his last wave.
Uh-huh.
Right? And this is like Scott saying, I want to do one big, like, final thing.
I was at one of the meetups recently, and we were all having a conversation about how your well of knowledge runneth over.
It's like, very there's weird. Just it's very nothing, weird.
There's nothing that you don't know everything about.
That's completely untrue.
And that's what they all say that you always say, but it's not true.
But it's a very weirdly specific thing. Like, there are other things where I'm like, well, I don't know what that
My
means.
My favorite is when we start a thing and you're like, I don't really know anything about that. And then the more we talk about it, the more it's like, it's as though you wrote the Wikipedia page.
It's so untrue.
It's wild.
No, oh my God. But, I just don't want people to think that I think that because...
No, nobody thinks that you think that.
Okay, good.
So, but here's my favorite part because FBI Sean, who like is obsessed
with... Oh, they fucking had it.
They've had it. And he's obsessed with getting Hollywood. So he decides he's sick of waiting around and reacting to like what Hollywood does.
A major part of it is that he's making them look really bad.
Yeah.
And like, nothing is going to light a fire under their asses.
He's
like,
sick of having to talk to Mike every day. He hates that guy. He's like, I'm the brain and the brawn, so like, what's going on?
The guy doing the Point Break cosplay is winning.
I know.
And it's been dozens of banks and all these years. Like, that must really chap their butts.
Well, because Sean really steps up. He gets very proactive. He says,
I sat down and did the math, figured out that he was going through approximately $21,000 a month. So with that in mind, I predicted that he was going to hit 1 of 3 days the following year in January.
The more Sean was saying, like, the numbers and the math, I was like, it's getting a little hot in here, Sean.
Oh, my God. Do you
love
Sean?
I'm getting a little turned on by Sean, like, just figuring out exactly, like, precisely a three-day window in over a year that he knew that he was going to hit next, and he was right.
Yeah, like, based on the math, the cops decide he's going to hit again in January.
Yes.
Because, meanwhile, Scott and Team Hollywood, they take a year off because they're planning this last big hit, their last big
wave. And they've got plenty of money. Yeah.
They called BFF Mark to come back into the crew. He hightailed it to Montana after the first one.
Yes.
They do 14 or 15 without him, and he's like, this is it. This is our big shot. Like, we're going to do this. And they convince Mark to join by saying, all you got to do is stand there. And he's like, I guess I'm in.
Right. And so January 25th, 1996, in preparation for the big three, like the last final hurrah, they're like, you know what? Mark is back. Let's give him, like, let's just do a test run with him and see how it goes. So they go and they do it. And Mark is just standing there and he's like, this one is great. It was so much more under control than the first one. Like, he said it felt more like a job than an adventure.
And Detective Mike was right that he was going to hit in January, but not the location.
Yeah.
So they get away with yet another robbery with $141,000. Mike was in the wrong place at the wrong time. He's like a mile away. By the time he hightails it to this bank, they're all gone.
Because you can't, like, they couldn't know exactly what bank, but they knew the time. Like, they knew the date. It had been, like, it's been a year, and they picked the right date. That just blew my mind. It was pretty amazing.
So the cops are like, we just got to tail this guy 100%. And we got to step up what we're doing to track him. And FBI Ellen is like, yeah, that was all my idea. And I'm like, you know what? Good for you for saying that. You fucking deserve it. So it was really complicated. There was a lot of moving parts, lots of tracking devices, these like new high-end things for the mid-90s.
Yeah, ProNet. Where it's like a little track. It's like what we would call an AirTag now.
Right.
And you put it in the stacks of cash.
Right. And tons of resources are being used. Like, it's kind of now or never. Like,
right. And they've got like every officer, they've got every FBI agent. It's like every single person in law enforcement in January of 1996 is staked out by a bank trying to find these guys.
And FBI Ellen, like the good guys and the bad guys, oversimplify it, they're all like, the vibe is starting to shift.
Uh-huh.
And everyone's feeling this sort of existential dread because FBI Ellen is like, I have to tell you, it's amazing to me that shit hasn't really gone down in all of these bank robberies in all of these years. No one's gotten hurt yet.
Yep.
Like, this is really bad. And she's like, it's got to be right around the corner. Now, that's FBI Ellen. Accomplice Steve is like, I had a dream where a shark bit both my legs off and I was crawling on the beach.
Suddenly, like, everybody in Seattle is having visions. He's like, not the only one having dreams.
Well, you don't have to be Columbo to figure out that, like, this is a bad idea to do these four banks in a night as your one last big wave.
And it's also just like, why? You know what I mean?
We know how Point Break ends. We know what happens to our dear beloved Patrick Swayze at the end of Point Break.
I know. And it's like, you have enough money. Why do you have
to? Who also was a bank robber. I know. There's nuance.
I know. I'm just saying everybody should quit. Everyone is saying this is going to end badly. This is going to end really badly. Like, well, how about you just don't do it?
Yeah, and his friends are having dreams about Scott dying. Yes. Scott is going around saying his final goodbye to people. Like, vibes are off, everyone.
Yeah.
So Steve is saying, like, I just had to get through it. Something had to finalize itself. I'm like, are you just quoting Point Break now? Like, what's going on? So we're 2 weeks out from, like, the big final robbery.
Yeah.
The bad news is that they now have ProNet tags in the vault money. There is no way to beat the tags in time to do our original plan. So we had to abandon the multiple bank scenario. The good news is we take this bank up on 125th Street. Mustang told us that there should be $5 to $7 million within the bank.
These tags are literally in a random stack of 20s. And if you're stealing $7, $8, $9, $10 million, you're having like hundreds of thousands of stacks of 20s.
And they can't do the multiple banks anymore because you can't drive and find the tag at the same time. Like,
right. And the point is you have to find the tag and get rid of it within a minute or else they're going to be able to track you down.
It's like a game.
Yeah. It's almost as though you shouldn't do this.
Game show. Yes.
You know what I mean?
Now, so they're like, all right, one bank and that's it.
Yeah.
Now, the bank is on 125th Street. And according to Mustang, there's going to be about like $5 to $7 million in the vault,
which is close
enough to the four banks.
Sure.
Whatever their number that they want to hit for this like last big risk. Mustang tells them $5 to $7 million. We'll get back to the total amount later.
So this is all going down November 27th, 1996. It's Thanksgiving Eve. And Sean, FBI Sean, says he woke up that day. The first thing his wife told him was, today's the day. You're going to catch him today.
Holy shit.
I know. Everyone in Seattle is psychic all of a sudden.
Everyone.
You know what I mean?
So Scott and Steve, the accomplice, start their day. They're putting on their disguises and their wigs.
Packing their shotguns.
All the shotgun, the assault rifle.
Can I just talk about this?
Guns went into a guitar case. Very Seattle.
Very Seattle. Their big plan is if the cops do find them and start to trail them, they're going to open the back door of the van, point the shotgun at the police car, and take out the engine.
And the assault rifle. And then it's every man for themselves.
As soon as I saw the number of guns that they had and that one of them was a shotgun and that they're like, all of a sudden I'm like, oh my God, this sweet documentary is going to end in a massacre. Yeah.
Yeah. And like everyone, it was almost everyone was like determined to make it happen.
Yes, absolutely.
So they're off. It's Thanksgiving Eve, Seafirst Bank in the Lake City branch.
Yeah.
Now, another Scott we're meeting.
Oh, I love Scott. I love this guy.
Scott, the bank manager. Yeah. Now, Scott, he's like, we have been trained specifically for the Hollywood Bandit.
Yep.
Who, I mean, he loves that name. He loves that Hollywood Bandit. So Hollywood walks into the bank right by his own wanted poster, which is so cinematic.
It's unbelievable. I cannot believe this hasn't been a movie.
I mean, it will be.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's got to be have been optioned or something.
It has to be.
Or something.
Perfect. It writes itself.
So manager Scott walks us through everything. And like, it truly is a nightmare come to life. Honestly, being like, you're just going about your day and then suddenly.
Well,
like,
because what nobody was prepared for is that now there's two Hollywoods. Remember, Mark is there with him, also in that same disguise. Like in every other scenario, it was just him.
Yeah.
Now there's two of them. And Scott's like, this is my worst nightmare.
And from 1991 to 1995, and especially in Seattle.
Yeah.
There are more and more alarms and more tracking devices here.
Yes.
That the robbers have not really taken into account. So manager Scott starts giving bank robber Scott the money that is already triggering an alarm.
He's triggering alarms left and right. When he's asked to go to open the vault, there's a certain code you can put in to open the vault.
Because he's the vault teller.
Yes.
So he's like, all right, you're coming with me. So manager Scott opens the vault using, quote, the special duress combination.
Yes.
Which means that it opens the vault like nothing is wrong. But meanwhile, another alarm is triggered.
And he goes,
I wanted every fucking law enforcement agency in Seattle there and there as quick as possible.
And I wanted there as quick as possible. He has been telling the story to his husband every single night
every
since
night.
This happened.
Of course. And I mean, it's also traumatizing.
And he's not saying it to be funny at all. You can tell that this is trauma for him.
It's horrible.
Yeah.
And like, I'm just thinking about poor Susan, who's been through it over a dozen times.
Yeah.
Like, what that must do to you is just like, oh my God. So all the alarms are coming in to the cops.
Mike, the cop, is saying, he's like, I'm sitting at this empty office because it's the night before Thanksgiving.
No
and I'm like,
working.
How did you all not know that this would be the night? Like, the night that he would know that there would be no cops on duty. Exactly. I'm like, you can't not be working. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Or like waiting around. Just be out in the field.
Yes.
So Hollywood hears about it on the police scanner because, of course, the robbers have a police scanner. And they're like, Hollywood, you've been seen. Get out. And they're like, okay. But this is when everything changes because this is when Scott, the bank robber, gets furious.
Yeah.
And now bank manager Scott, in the middle of all this, And this is, it's chaos the way he's describing it. He's totally, but he's been trained for this.
Yeah.
Manager Scott, in the middle of all this chaos, is able to throw a tracker into the bag of money.
Yes.
Unbeknownst to the bank robbers.
Yeah, so like they're going to be looking for it in the stacks of cash, but it won't be there. It's just randomly thrown into this bag of money.
Right. Now, Team Hollywood, they are off and running.
Yeah.
They throw the bags into the van. They have about $1 million, not the $5 to $7 million that Mustang promised.
But you can't imagine how much actual cash that is. And that's where
like
the
physically
physical
dollar bills.
Dollar bills, because they've got to find these two trackers in between these stacks of 20s.
It was such a panic with all the police out buzzing around. We knew that they were hunting us. We had taken $1,080,000 out of the bank, and it was too difficult to find the tracking devices.
And there's like hundreds of stacks of 20s.
And it's impossible.
And they only have a minute or two before the cops are going to be able to like triangulate their location. Because we should also say, this was 1996. This was not AirTags. We're looking at our iPhones. This is like, the cops had specialized equipment in their cars that could track these trackers. But they had to triangulate it the same way that we would do with cell phones today.
Yeah. But it's chaos in the van. Everyone's panicking.
Yeah.
It's a ticking time bomb. There's no order to what they're doing. It's dark in the back of the van. There is there's no way based on how they're doing it. Because it's one of those things where like,
they find one tracker. They throw
one.
It out. Yeah.
But like, it's one of those things where like, you're throwing a stack of 20s on someone else's stack of 20s.
Yes,
like, it's too much small of a space. There's no order to it. Like, it's, of course, the cops are going to catch up to them.
Yeah.
They do.
Yeah.
And now we have a major showdown, like a crazy gunfight.
And now the thing that's to remember too is Ellen, the head honcho here from the FBI, is in one of these police cruisers. And like, all of these people have families. You know what I mean? And like, the gunfight that is described here is, I can't even imagine it.
Now, Steve, the accomplice, says the cops ambushed them and started shooting out of nowhere. The cops say the actual, literal, complete opposite.
Yes.
The truth is that I think everyone just started firing at once.
Yeah, 100%.
Like, it was just sort of like, go.
Yeah.
So it is a full, everyone's at 100. It's a full-on firefight. Bullets are whizzing by. People are saying, like, it's out of a movie.
Scott was driving at this point. So in the back was Mark and Steve, and they are getting shot to hell.
Yeah.
And Scott.
Scott the bank robber, like Scott Hollywood.
Yeah, Scott Hollywood. Steve says to us, we always say that if it came down to a gunfight like this, it was every man for himself.
Yep.
There's no loyalty among thieves, literally. And so Scott grabs his shotgun and runs into the night.
Now, accomplice Steve is begging, and Steve tells us this, begging the cops to shoot and kill him. He's like, I don't want to go to prison. At that point, nothing mattered. Life was over. But then...
this is so wild.
He has this moment.
And suddenly, this beautiful, divine music came into my head. I've never heard earthly music like it. And the money became almost like this talisman of, what is it? It's a bunch of paper. Who gives a shit? Who does what people do for this stupid stuff that has no meaning, really?
He's been doing all this stupid shit for nothing.
Yeah.
And nothing matters. And like, it just sort of all he had, I mean, I guess like you'd call that like a come to Jesus moment.
Yeah.
In the middle of a firefight when he knows he's caught.
Exactly. And it's also like, you really think the cop is just going to kill you because you asked him to? Like, what?
No.
No.
Well, I don't know. But so BFF Mark, who
I mean, as soon as he knows that that's what you want, that's not what's happening.
And they
you know what I mean?
They want to be able to parade you around in front of the media.
Exactly.
Because you were making a fool out of these guys for so long. So BFF Mark, the one who went to one bank robbery, ran to Montana, and now he's back.
Yeah.
He's been shot and injured, and he's going in and out of consciousness.
Like, it really looks like Mark's about to die.
And one of the FBI guys says today, he was like, I realized, oh, shit, I think I just killed someone.
Yeah,
woof,
I know,
woof,
I know,
woof,
I know.
Woof, woof. So BFF Mark survived, but he's super relieved it's all over. He just wants to be done. He never wanted to be here in the first place. He was promised all he had to do was stand there and do nothing. He's like, I should have stayed in Montana.
Yeah, because you're going to jail, girl.
Like,
so FBI Sean goes to see Steve in the hospital. Now, Steve is a mess. His arm has been shot to hell. But FBI Sean gets him to talk.
Because Scott Hollywood is at large.
Yes.
And BFF Mark and accomplice Steve are taken into custody and treated for all their injuries.
And Steve, after 2 hours, gives the name. It's Scott Scurlock is Hollywood.
Now, the cops are going door to door. They're canvassing the area.
Yeah.
And finally,
we hear 911 calls and the dispatchers being like, yes, we know things are going on. Stop tying up the emergency line.
And finally, someone's like, I think that Hollywood guy's in my yard. Like, I think he's in my camper.
This was like the Boston bomber of it all.
Oh,
remember,
God.
Like, we was hiding in that guy's boat in Watertown.
But this is like, I don't know if this is editing or what, but the cops are fucking idiots here. Because they go to the camper in the yard.
This, I have the same question.
So they bust the window and spray in pepper spray. And a moment later, they hear a single gunshot. The officers fire back into the camper. I was told that 76 rounds had been fired into the camper by officers who were at the scene.
The officers fire back into the camper 76 rounds.
Yeah.
hundreds of officers descend on the scene. It's very over the top. The entire neighborhood is out. People are like, oh, also it's Thanksgiving, by the way.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Like, everyone stop fighting about politics. There's a fucking gunfight on the front lawn. Like, Thanksgiving Day, everyone is descending outside. It's like a major, like, this is Hollywood, no question. But what I don't understand, the cops are like, this is a standoff. I'm like, wait. There was one single gunshot.
This was my same question. Like, it's so clear that the guy, whoever is in the camper, is definitely dead.
Like,
and every cop, and it takes like 12 hours for them to decide to go in.
2 hours, but still way too long. Because, so they do the pepper spray. There's one single gunshot. They then fire 76 rounds into the camper. They think it's a standoff, and they're sitting there in silence for 2 hours.
Yes.
And so after 2 hours of no response, that's a direct quote, we go into the camper. And they realize that Scott is dead, and that first shot was Scott killing himself.
Which everybody
obviously
knew. Yeah.
Or from the 76 rounds that you went in there.
Yeah, no.
We're going to sit here wondering.
But you know what? It was the same thing with the Boston bomber in Watertown. Like, every cop in the world was there, and it took him forever to go into the boat.
Like, he's just sitting there in silence.
Right.
After your 76 rounds.
I know.
After you thought you didn't think anything of that single gunshot. What did you think he was doing with one single gunshot?
Yeah.
When there was no bullet hole in the fucking camper. What do you think happened?
Exactly.
Like, it's just so weird.
Yeah. It just ends by, like, talking. Like, we're talking to Suzanne, the sister, and she's in shock. And then we get FBI Sean, who's saying he wouldn't have shot into the back of that van. FBI Sean wants to put this all on Mike and said that, like, to say that Hollywood is dead because Mike shot into the back of the van, and if it had been me, I wouldn't have done that. Quote, there's always another day to catch him. Mm-hmm. Like, he wanted to take him alive.
And we learned that
Scott and I had several discussions about what are you going to do if we get caught? And he would always, always say, I'm not going to prison. I'm going to head for the white light.
He wanted to go towards the light, which, again, not making a joke, is very Point Break.
Yeah.
Which I'm saying, like, he saw something in this movie and really, like, took a lot of the, like, even, like, the philosophical points of that movie. Like, that movie meant a lot to him. All jokes aside, like,
no,
even,
truly.
Even his ending is very much like he saw a lot of himself in Bodhi in himself or whatever, Patrick Swayze's character.
Yeah.
Clearly. Like, very, it resonated with him in a way that we don't really, like, see that much.
It's not true.
Just, like, oh, someone, you know, you hear about people doing these, like, awful, violent things because they want, you know, the fucking people who like Scarface and all that.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that in the TikTok murders. But, like, he, like, really felt seen by this movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, because it described exactly the way that he felt about himself.
Yeah.
You know, a person who, like, lived outside the law. And we learned that woman Mustang took her own life.
Yeah. But she would visit Steve the accomplice, like, every year on the anniversary and then eventually died by suicide. And then we also hear about, like, but there are people who experienced a lot of trauma.
This was like really, really powerful. When this happens to you, when you live through something like this, like we were saying earlier, it just stays with you.
Of course.
They say that you can go on with your life, but like this never leaves. And that to me was a really important thing to hear, because you think of a bank robbery as a victimless crime, and it definitely isn't.
No, it's not. Yeah. Because you think, oh, the bank is insured. Oh, whatever. Like,
right.
When you say victimless crime, you're talking only in money
and
physical thing. But like also, it could not be a victimless crime physically, but mentally, emotionally, and psychologically, it's terrifying.
I mean, it's like the D.B. Cooper thing where it's like everybody thinks of him as, they call him like the gentleman hijacker. And it's like, no, he hijacked a plane.
That's a nightmare.
These crimes are not victimless.
Right. And it's like, okay, he had like cute curly long hair and lived in a treehouse. But at the same time, like dozens of bank robberies is like hundreds of people potentially who were traumatized.
We also learned that the treehouse crumbled within a year of Scott's death. Like they describe it as like they were the heart and soul of each other.
Uh-huh.
And the treehouse just couldn't stand without him being there.
Right. And then Scott's ashes were eventually spread where the treehouse was.
Yeah. So we got the on-screen text at the end. We learned between 1992 and 1996, the Hollywood Bandits robbed 19 confirmed banks. They stole over $2.3 million. In 1997, Steve Myers and Mark Biggins were sentenced to 21 years and 3 months in prison. No other accomplices were ever charged.
Yeah. It's crazy. Wild. It's a crazy story.
And Seth, the director, congratulations. Very well told. Everyone should go watch this.
Yes.
It's so good.
Yeah. Co-director, but yes.
Yes.
I'm not saying that for Seth. I just wanted to try to
Oh, fam, we did How to Rob a Bank. Girl, I knew what it was called. Are you proud of me?
I mean, at this point, yes. I just thrilled, beyond.
So, fam, quick reminder, merch is live for all Patreon members starting at 11 a.m. Eastern today, September 3rd. Merch is live for Patreon exclusively for the next 24 hours. It also comes along with a 10% discount for the Patreon, fam. That discount is good as long as the merch is available. You find the discount code in your email or over on our Patreon page.
Yeah, and then September 4th, merch is open to everybody. movie. So have fun. Go forth and merch. We're really excited about it.
Yes, and don't forget, also right now, our interview with Seth Porges is live on Patreon as well. We talked about everything in this episode that we thought was insane. Seth came into the studio, sat with us, and like, we really dug in. We really got the answers to the things we wanted to know.
Yeah, grab your flannel, put on Pearl Jam's 10, watch Point Break. It's just living those old Seattle vibes. You know what I mean?
Yes, 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 yes. All right, what are we doing next, girl?
Are you ready, girl? This is a you pick. This is a you demand.
What is it?
Unsolved Mysteries Volume 4, Episode 2, Body in the Basement.
Oh my God. So you all know that I'm obsessed with Unsolved Mysteries. Have you watched it yet?
I've watched it.
It's this one is a doozy. When this one came out, there was all this scuttlebutt on Instagram Reels, which is where I watch my videos.
And people, I'm on TikTok.
I know. I don't do TikTok, but I'm on Instagram Reels.
Yes.
And there was so much scuttlebutt about, like, don't watch this one alone. It's so scary. What really happened?
And
it's crazy.
It's not supernatural, maybe. It's a very, or is it? I don't know. But it's a very, like, what the hell happened
what
here?
What the hell happened here? I can't wait to watch this one again.
Oh, I'm like, I have a lot to say about it. It might be an extended. Yeah.
Great. All right, we'll stay tuned for the trailer for that, fam.
Right.
And our funny and hilarious outtakes. I think there's probably some here.
I think so.
We'll see.
I'm not going to apologize for my Point Break. I felt
Why?
The...
What? Who's asking
felt,
you to?
I felt the womanly urge to apologize for Point Break. I felt it coming up in all my Eddie Vedder stuff. But no, I'm not. I'm going to stand in my Point Break Eddie Vedder love.
I wouldn't have it any other way.
Okay, great.
Okay, great.
Standing firm.
All right, we love you, fam.
We love you.
Bye.
911 for what town or city?
Calgary.
Ambulance, police, or fire?
Oh my God, all.
Okay, tell me exactly what happened.
I don't know. And I just came home and I found my wife downstairs and there's blood everywhere.
Are you with her now?
No.
Is she awake? Is she breathing?
Oh my God.
Is she breathing?
Hold on one second. There's so much blood. No, she's gone.
I'm sending help. No. I'm sending someone to assist you.
Oh my God.
I don't really know, like, if I'm a human person anymore.
It's a very strange time.
I'm not really sure if I'm here or not. Yeah. Am I here? Am I present?
I think so. But then again, I think it's all a simulation.
I don't know. Okay. Ready?
Yeah. Jodie Foster and Anthony Hopkins did not speak to each other on the set. She's, like, afraid of him to this day.
I know. She was, like, traumatized. I actually just watched Panic Room for the first time.
Oh, it's a terrible movie.
I thought it was, like, a feminine. I loved her in it. And it was young. Oh, my God. Kristen Stewart.
Oh, I saw the movie theater when it first came out. So I haven't seen it in a long time. You know, it's the record.
It's very David Fincher. It takes place in a rainstorm.
Yes.
I'm thrilled.
Okay.
The women win. Sorry.
Yeah,
spoiler.
Totally. The look of wonder on your face at a bank.
A full-ass bank.
But it's not like a freestanding structure within the structure.
Do they have those pens that are connected?
Yo, 100%.
Okay.
How else are you going to, like, write your deposit slip? And
there's never ink in it.
That's true. Mike is like, you know, he's just like standing there in whatever mask he's wearing. Like, this one is going great.
Mike is the cop.
I have it as Mike because I did the replace.
Detective Mike. Okay.
You're right.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.